revelation is Savonarola takes over. He's preaching. The people are in the bonfire of the vanities. Reform is sweeping through the city of Florence and then was threatening to sweep through all of the city-states of Italy. And the Pope, Pope Alexander VI, sided with Savonarola's enemies and he was murdered. At that point, the church lost control of the discussion. It lost intellectual control. They did not resolve the usury issue in the way that the Muslims had resolved this centuries before. And the next time there was a protest against the decadence in the church, it was a German monk by the name of Martin Luther, and that caused one of the most massive looting operations in all of European history, which is otherwise known as the Protestant Reformation, where the princes stole the property of the church, and Luther and other Protestant leaders in all of these countries, Scotland, Sweden, John Knox was in, same thing, legitimatized or sanctified or approved of this looting of property in exchange for a certain amount of property and a new status as a state church. And now you had geographical areas that were physically beyond the police power of the church. Even if they wanted to enforce it, they couldn't now. And these were some parts of Germany. They were mostly won back by the Counter-Reformation. But England remained too difficult, and the Spanish Netherlands, the Habsburgs, could not get the entire Spanish Netherlands back, and so Holland, the northern provinces, became an outpost of the new religion. And the new religion, I think, is what Karl Marx said it was. I think Protestantism is the worship of mammon. It's Christians acting like Jews, which means collecting usury on loans. The legitimatization of usury began not with Luther, but with Calvin, who said that if it was a productive loan, then you could charge. In other words, if a businessman was borrowing money, it was different than a poor man, and so on and so forth, has led to the situation that we're in today. Basically, once the church's police power was broken, once they did not solve the usury problem, these outposts were created, and they had basically usury-based economies. And they came over here. In other words, the Puritans, when they were expelled, when that fell through in England, they came over here, and so we had America then involved in that. Henry VIII was one of these wretched monsters who was just nothing but appetite and got into trouble with his finances because he was in debt. And the temptation, having seen the example of what happened in Germany, decided he could do the same thing in England, even though he was opposed to the Lutherans, and tried to create some type of via media, like halfway between Catholicism and Protestantism, Lutheranism. So basically, he authorized the seizure and looting of the monasteries. One of the reasons it succeeded as well as it did is he had to cut in a lot of the nobility, cut them in on the looting operation. And so there were certain families that became fabulously wealthy by the looting of church property. So basically, what you had was 900 years of stored labor. Overnight, ripped from the matrix where it was put to the social good and stolen and looted and put into the hands of thieves. And so what you had was basically a criminal conspiracy in charge of Europe now. And lots of criminals in on it, and so therefore it created a kind of criminal caste.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
And lots of criminals in on it, and so therefore it created a kind of criminal caste in Europe that would now be dead set against everything that the Catholic Church stood for because of the guilt that they incurred from this theft. Because of the guilt that the English ruling class has been bearing for all these years, because all of their wealth and all of their power came from the looting of the Catholic Church. Enormous amounts of wealth were destroyed. I mean, Cobbett goes into this. these prayer books, these missals that had gold and jewels encrusted. These people just bust in, they rip the cover off, rip the jewels off, throw the thing, this illuminated manuscript, in the mud, their horses trample on it, and they're off to the next monastery to loot that one. Hundreds of years, centuries of stored labor and acquired wealth gone within a period of a year or so. And then, of course, the people who got a hold of it then wanted more, and they started, there was this big land speculation, and people were taking out mortgages on the land, and that's when the usury came in, and then it started to concentrate into fewer and fewer hands. And misery across the board, because the people who lived, who benefited from these properties, were no longer able to benefit from them. There were things like purgatory societies in England, where a certain man would bequeath a certain property, piece of land, to the church. The church would set up a purgatory society, whereas if you prayed for this man's soul, you could graze your sheep on his land, or you could use this land for something or other. Social use of the land, all of this was totally abrogated. The peasants, the agricultural class was driven from the land. The land was enclosed, and sheep were raised, because that was big business at this time, because there was this voracious appetite for English wool in places like Florence to make cloth. And so you created people like Cobbett and Belloc and Chesterton and Marx, all across the political spectrum, would say this was the beginning of the creation of the proletariat in England. And never, in a sense, never went away. Never went away. And so what you had in the 19th century, after economic advance, after industrialism, after all these things, you realize these people are permanently miserable. And nothing seems to change their lot, and it gave rise to socialism, which Pesch refers to, wherever you have the disease of capitalism, you are going to have the purulent boil of socialism as the manifestation that the body, the political body, is sick. And so what you had then was socialism as the example, and then you go to England and you see, you know, large areas of indigenous, you know, people are not foreigners there, buying lottery tickets, you know? Going to soccer games, soccer hoodlums.
The police and what appears to be a section of the Manchester United support involved...
The proletariat continued and never really emerged from that kind of degradation. The state, in a sense, funneled the more money because of socialism, but it never really recovered. England never recovered. So all that wealth was taken, stolen, concentrated, and turned into a kind of predatory economic system that we now call capitalism. It's the spirit that counts. It's not the flesh. There's always going to be some type of manifestation. This is the problem with trying to identify Jews with a particular political direction, especially in America, like Jews in the 30s. They're all communists. So how can they be conservatives? Well, the neoconservative movement was more revolutionary than the Communist Party of the 1930s in terms of actually an implementation of Trotsky's principles of actually going out and conquering other people. It's just that they attached this revolutionary fervor to the United States instead of to the Soviet Union. That's why it's important to identify the spirit and not a particular manifestation. You can't mistake the part for the whole. Capitalism, according to Heinrich Pesch, is state-sponsored usury. And it's the appropriation, the systematic appropriation of all surplus value. So the first reform would be to eliminate usury. And that would be the alternative. And that one of the places that has eliminated usury is the Islamic world, and Islamic banking has banking without usury, where you can have fees instead of compound interest. So that's the simplest answer I can come up with. a history of capitalism is different than a history of economic development, even though they do have similarities, because capitalism is a predatory ideology that preys on legitimate economic activity through usury primarily. And we've reached a point where people, if you say you're against capitalism, they say, well, don't you believe in economic development, or don't you believe in, you know, science, or don't you believe, whatever. We have been so brainwashed that we've confused the disease with the person. The other aspect is that whenever capitalism runs into trouble, they loot. In America, they loot pension funds. That is always the first thing. And so you always have a capitalist saying, well, we can't afford Social Security anymore. Well, wait a minute, why can't we can afford all these wars, but we can't afford Social Security? This is the penchant to loot labor. Usury concentrates wealth into fewer and fewer hands. And so a group like the Jews, that is always a small minority, will be interested in strategies that will concentrate wealth. They've also had centuries of experience in dealing with it, from small-time stuff to big-time stuff. And so they would naturally gravitate toward this. They have become experts in using these covert means of taking over the culture, using finance in a predatory way that is covert, and so most people don't see them as being involved in it. You have to have trust. And I'm saying that this is the problem with Jewish involvement in finance. They're taught not to trust the goyim. They're taught to exploit the goyim. This is what they learn from the Talmud. Eventually, through usury, they take control, and there's no trust in the society, and the society breaks down. And that's where we stand now. I mean, investment. Would you feel confident investing your money in some type of Wall Street operation, and not feel that it was going to be stolen from you? This is the problem. This is what's causing the breakdown of the economic system now. We have to clarify, what is a Jew? Okay, we've already tried the theological basis. Now, when you say a Jew, the Jews do X. I'm talking about the Jewish people. The Jewish people are an organized entity whose constitution is the Talmud, which is anti-logos. It is a way of keeping Jewish people from the truth and keeping Jewish people from Christ. So what you're talking about is a Jewish control mechanism. The Jewish leaders keep the Jewish people captive in order to push their agenda. Israel Shamir said that Jewish people are the human shields for the Jewish leaders. Totally debilitating. It's totally debilitating. And it's so debilitating, we don't even know we're blind. That's the problem. It's like conducting a military campaign and you're firing the artillery into fake tanks. Well, you're not firing at the target. You don't even know what the target is. It's been so suppressed that I'm saying we have to go back at least 100 years. In the culture wars, we're going to publish the three-part series that appeared in Civiltà Cattolica in 1890 on the Jewish question. Because that's when all of Europe was dealing with the Jewish question. Because largely of the predatory nature of Jewish finance in the 19th century. So I'm saying it's totally debilitating. We don't have this vocabulary. We can't talk about it. We are always engaging in something like, you'd have to call shadow boxing. Is it the liberals who are the problem, or is it the conservatives who are the problem? Is it the Democrats who are the problem, or is it the Republicans? Well, to give you some reference point, after President Obama announced his initiative about going back to the 67 borders.
The borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps.
Within one day, Benjamin Netanyahu showed up in this country, and the entire Congress of the United States gave him 29 standing ovations. A totally disgusting act of groveling before a foreign potentate that you would think would be impossible in a country like the United States. But they did it, and not only did they do that, they were told to do it by IPAC, and they were told, these congressmen, that if you don't do it, you will never get any money. Now, what is that, a Republican issue or is that a Democrat issue? No, that's a Jewish issue. And if we don't have the vocabulary to deal with it, we're crippled. And that's exactly the situation. We're crippled. The government is totally unresponsive to the people of the United States. Oh, my name is Irving Kristol, and my son's name is Bill. In my youth I followed Trotsky, and in truth I follow him still. But to call yourself a Bolshevik would fill the world with dread, dread. So please don't call me a commie, call me a neocon instead. Yes, we are the neoconservatives. We rule the world, says I. And that dumb goy we call Georgie Boy doesn't understand how or why. Oh, we're marching into Syria. The fun has just begun. Comrade Trotsky would be proud to be known as a neocon. To keep the toy pacified while watching their TV, we let them watch dumb Irishmen like Sean O'Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, and Chris Matthews. They can lick our boots and sigh, but to run the New World Order, no dumb Irish need apply. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson support us on TV while waiting to be raptured into pre-eternity. Oh, we're marching into Syria. The fun has just begun. Comrade Trotsky will be proud to be known as a neocon. Hammurabi's tablets got busted during the looting in Iraq. But we're marching into Syria behind George Bush's back. They've got weapons of mass destruction, and they got them from Saddam Hussein. They've got weapons of mass destruction. They've got weapons of mass destruction, oh believe me, oh believe. If you want to know just where they are, they're hidden in Tel Aviv.